Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, January 24th, 2012, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call on the doctrine of Cypre. My name is David Ray, and I'm the Associate Director of the Federalist Society's Practice Groups. Two quick announcements before we begin. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, so all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. Also, this call is being recorded for possible future use as a podcast or other online use. Our moderator today is Mrs. Margaret Little. Mrs. Little is an attorney in Stratford, Connecticut, in private practice. Her practice focuses on commercial litigation and appeals in state and federal courts. She's also the director of the Federal Society's Pro Bono Center. Mrs. Little will introduce our speakers and the topic today. Peggy, go right ahead.
Welcome to the Federalist Society Forum. Who should receive unclaimed class action awards? The Tale of Cypre. Cypre is a doctrine borrowed from the law of trusts, and it has in recent years been adopted by courts in litigation to distribute class action funds for purposes or to recipients other than those presented by the original class action plaintiffs. This once rare and now increasingly common practice has come under fire for lacking a foundation in applicable law and representing a wholly discretionary exercise of judicial power. Indeed, prominent scholars, judges, and legal commentators have argued that the practice is not an appropriate or lawful judicial function, that it violates the doctrine of constitutional separation of powers, that it employs a procedural rule to transform substantive law applicable only to parties to a lawsuit into an utterly discretionary compensatory mechanism. Such critics suggest that it is time to rethink the justifications of this practice and whether substantive law can be lawfully used to direct defendants to pay damages to uninjured non-parties or charitable entities. We have two distinguished panelists with us today, and they will. This will begin with attorney Patrick J. Perotti. Mr. Perotti is a certified employment law specialist with the Ohio law firm Dworkin & Bernstein, where he practices class action, employment, consumer, and commercial litigation. Also with us today is Ted Frank, founder of the Center for Class Action Fairness. He is also an adjunct fellow of the Manhattan Institute. He has been a resident fellow with the American Enterprise Institute, and he has focused much of his career on class action law and reform. Mr. Perotti?
Thank you very much. I appreciate you giving us the opportunity to speak today. In a class action, a defendant agrees in writing in a settlement agreement at the end of the case, instead of going to judgment, to pay a sum of $3 million. At the end of the day, as a result of not being able to find a number of the class members, or the class members having been deceased, or for other reasons, that distribution cannot be made. The question that Cypre addresses in most instances where we've dealt with it in my law firm is exactly that situation. It's not an issue of an unfettered or untethered activity by a judge who says, I want to do X, Y, and Z with certain monies that don't belong to me. It's not a device used to generate additional funds for class counsel, and it's not a device to require the defendant to pay anything. The Cypre that we're talking about in my practice is a Cypre which occurs only when the defendant has agreed as part of a settlement agreement to pay out a certain fund of money. Now, in the class action watch on Cypre settlements, where Ted Frank, who's the other speaker, wrote for the Federalist Society, he indicated correctly that Cypre settlements arise in three circumstances. And the first one, which we were just talking about, is a fixed settlement fund that exceeds the amount that is actually paid out because less than the total number of class members have come to register claims. Now, Cypre comme possible is from the Norman French, and it means as nearly as possible. And it was borrowed from a doctrine which was used in ancient Roman law of wills and trusts. And one of the first examples is the building of aqueducts. An individual died and gave money in their bequest for aqueducts to be built for the city. Now, by the time they finally passed, the aqueducts had already been built by someone else. And so the city fathers had to deal with the issue of what do we do with this bequest? How do we make the best intent of the testator come to life? And they used the doctrine of cypre in order to transfer the use of those monies from that use to another use. In the case that I gave as an example, the parties have agreed in a court document for a settlement based on a payment of a fund called X. When this issue was debated before the Ohio General Assembly, surprisingly, you would think that a lot of the conservative Republicans, and I'm a Republican, by the way, would have opposed the issue because it, quote, fetters business with the obligation to pay more than their just share. But in fact, it was strongly supported and, in fact, sponsored by one of the more conservative Republicans in the Ohio General Assembly. And the reason it was given is because the doctrine and the use in a proper method promotes truth in settlements. It's a situation in which there is an agreement by a court. And remember, a court is the one in a class action, unlike under Rule 41 in an individual case. If we have an individual lawsuit, myself against one of the members in the audience, and we decide to come to a settlement, and the judge says, hey, folks, what's the settlement? We're legitimate in saying to the judge, none of your business. Because a court does not have the jurisdiction to approve or disapprove or give any type of imprimatur to a settlement between the private parties on the docket in front of that particular judge. There's a couple of exceptions under Rule 41, and those exceptions are under Rules 23, 23.1, and 66. 66, of course, is receiverships, which deal with the fact that you're not just addressing the rights of the named parties, you're addressing the rights of other people who have to deal through a received business. 23 and 23.1, similarly, don't just extinguish the rights of the named plaintiff. They extinguish the rights of class members who are not before the court. And as a result of that, a court has to approve what is or isn't proper in that context of settlement. And allowing a party to gain an approval of a court for a class action settlement based on a term, for example, of we will pay $3 million, but then quietly pay only $1.4 million and pocket the rest is neither honest nor proper. It doesn't do justice to the court. It doesn't do justice to the system, where people say already that there's not enough transparency, and it certainly doesn't do justice to the second reason why class actions use cypre, and that is, what's the purpose of a class action? It has two functions. It's not just to redress the wrongs of the individuals whose money was taken. The second more important, I think, function of class actions is what's called disgorgement. Class actions aren't solely to pay a class member's $9. They're to disgorge the defendant of some or all of the $9 million, which resulted from a practice which charged each person a small amount, but did so over a very large group. And the court in the Federal Circuit Court in the Allstate case said, disgorgement wrests ill-gotten gains from the hands of a wrongdoer, and it does it in equity to prevent them from enriching themselves. And the courts have made it very clear that this type of disgorgement in class actions, contrary to what some opponents of cypre and class actions have indicated, is not punitive. The disgorgement is remedial and not punitive. The Allstate Court explained that. And it is for quasi-compensation and quasi-deterrence, and that's the Pearson versus Perrier case. It's the idea that if an insurance company, for example, double charges customers, and instead of collecting $3 million, collects $6 million for the exact same fee, which they managed to get an extra payment for by listing it as something else somewhere else on the deck sheet. And at the end of the day, they know that most of the money, or even a large portion of the money that they've gathered after litigation, will still stay in their pocket after they've paid all their judgments and their attorney's fees. What is the likelihood from a societal standpoint that the next time they're presented the opportunity to make a business decision, they will make a fair decision as compared to a fraudulent decision? The Perrier Court explained, this is the next best use because it serves the broad consumer protection and it also deters corporate wrongdoing by forcing companies to disgorge rather than to keep monies which were obtained by improper means. There are six states in the country, and the idea of that there's going to be a lot of talk about If you read the articles about shady selection of charities and coupon settlements, and there are many, many issues that need to be addressed in this field. But the concept of saying CyPRE itself is improper and not a valid judicial function is not correct. And we can see, for example, that six states have mandated CyPRE in all class action resolutions. The state of Washington, North Carolina, Illinois, South Dakota, California, and Utah, and three have codified the common law, and those are Tennessee, the District of Columbia, and Colorado. And I'll wrap up by saying, as you can see from that collection of states, this is not all the liberal left or the conservative right. It's a patchwork of states all around the country whose legislatures saw the wisdom of making sure that when people in front of a court make a representation to a judge wearing a robe, that they're going to do a certain thing, that at the end of the day, that's exactly what they do.
Thank you. We will now move to Ted Frank, and I briefly introduced him earlier. Mr. Frank is the founder of the Center for Class Action Fairness. Ted?
Thanks for having me. And I'll start by noting that I'm not one of those people that says there should never be CyPRE. There is, I think, a colorable argument to that effect, and you should read the work of Martin Reddish on the left on that question, and also Judge Edith Jones's concurrence in the Fifth Circuit case last year, Clear versus Elf Ottokem, for those arguments. But my argument with respect to CyPRE is narrower, and that is that it's too frequently being used as a first resort rather than a last resort. And when it is not used as a last resort, and sometimes even when it is used as a last resort, it presents conflicts of interest that courts have not consistently been cognizant of. And we can start with the sort of conflict of interest that arises between the charitable recipient and the defendant. For example, I was involved in a class action, in an objection to a class action settlement against Kellogg. Kellogg donates about $90 million worth of food to food banks every year. And this settlement, in addition to paying the lawyers very handsomely, called for Kellogg's to donate another $2.5 million of food to food banks. The problem there is that there, when you have a corporate defendant that already has a very substantial charitable program, there's simply no way of distinguishing between the charity that the defendant is doing as part of its public relations with the community and the charity that it is doing as part of a class action settlement. What is probably happening in almost every single one of these cases is that there's just simply a change in accounting entries. What was it's going from one bucket in the defendant's accounting to another bucket in the defendant's accounting, but there's no material change in the defendant's relationship to the world, much less the class. Yet the attorneys are seeking and receiving payment as sort of a commission for changing the classification of the bucket from where the charitable monies are coming. And when that's happening, that sort of increased attorney's fee is actually coming at the expense of the class. It's a way to increase the attorney's fees that would be provided in a settlement, whereas if it was a normally structured settlement, it would be harder for the attorneys to actually rationalize the fees that they are receiving. The second sort of conflict of interest, and I think this is a potentially very serious one, is the sort of conflict of interest that comes between the judge when the judge has too large of a role in the selection of the CyPRE recipient. If I had a motion to dismiss pending, and I went to the judge and said, "Judge, this motion to dismiss is very important to me, and if you grant this motion to dismiss, I will put $1 million in a slush fund that you could donate to any charity you want," the U.S. attorneys would be sent after me, and I would be serving a very long prison term. However, in the class action settlement context, it's considered entirely appropriate to create this exact same slush fund, tell the judge, give it to whoever charity you want, let charities lobby the judge to see who gets the money, and nobody complains. And you see some really striking cases, such as the Puerto Rico judge who, in a case involving a hotel fire, gave the Cypre money to an animal welfare charity. Or in a recent lawsuit where the only settlement, the only payment made by the defendant was to essentially the Cypre fund for the judge to distribute, the judge unilaterally, without any notice to the class, decided that $250,000 of the fund would go to a university that was paying him to teach as an adjunct. And these sorts of potential conflicts of interest can be very serious. There was a recent disciplinary case against a judge in Georgia where the judge was exceedingly generous with Cypre and in structuring settlements so that there was a lot of Cypre, and then was being honored by the very local institutions where the Cypre money was going. And we even beyond that, we see national class actions where the Cypre recipients are very local and local to what the judge is doing. And aside from the very obvious conflicts of interest for a judge, where a judge is sort of benefiting if it's a charity that's favorable to the judge or whatnot, you just have the potential where a judge will be incentivized to make rulings that will encourage a settlement that creates the Cypre funds that gives the judge power to distribute the monies. And I think this is something that the system is not fully cognizant of and is not fully taking into account and not doing enough to stop judges from doing that and the potential problems that it arises. And then the third type of conflict of interest, I think, is even more serious, and that's where the charity or the Cypre recipient is something affiliated with the plaintiff's attorney. And, you know, there are two sort of academic views of the class action. Is the class action, you know, sort of is the class just sort of this generic entity and the plaintiff's lawyer for the class is doing general good for society? Or is the plaintiff's lawyer actually representing clients to whom he has a fiduciary duty to? And the Supreme Court has said consistently that the class action is a procedural device. This is not a free-flowing private attorney general. You have clients. You have duties to clients. In the settlement context, the adequacy of representation is very important. And the first duty of a plaintiff's lawyer is to his or her own clients. And if the settlement is structured so that the money is going to a Cypre charity that the plaintiff's lawyer prefers rather than to his or her own clients, there's a very real conflict of interest. And you can see that the plaintiff's lawyer realizes some non-pecuniary benefit from being seen as the person who gives out these charitable awards to Cypre. They show up in these very public ceremonies with giant oversized checks. Look what I have accomplished for this charity. They get their picture on the cover of lawyer magazines as lawyer of the year for their charitable contributions. But it's not their charitable contributions. It's their client's charitable contributions, and the lawyer is the one doing it. And that potential conflict of interest can have very real effects in that the lawyer's incentive is not to ensure that the class gets the most money possible, but it has no objection to any sort of claims process that makes it harder for his clients to collect, because any leftover money is going to the charity, and the lawyer would prefer the money to go to the charity than to have the $9 check go to an ungrateful client 1,000 miles away. whereas the lawyer can instead have the money go to a local charity that will support him politically in the future. So you have some very serious conflicts of interest there, and for that reason, my clients, when we object to class action settlements, we ask courts to look at Section 3.07 of the American Law Institute's Principles of the Law of Aggregate Litigation. And there that says you use CyPRE as a last resort. You use it when there's just no way to get the money to the class. That would be if there's leftover money, the leftover money should go to the class members who have made a claim unless it will result in a windfall. And it's very rare that it results in a windfall. There are very few class action settlements that provide that the class members are fully compensated to the full extent that has been claimed in the original complaint. But instead, we are seeing very many settlements where class members get a fraction of the underlying claim, yet money is being given to third parties that are completely unrelated to the class. The other thing that the AOI recommends is to ensure that there is a complete independence between the CyPRE recipients and the plaintiffs and the defendants and the judicial system. And that is something that courts have not fully always considered. And, you know, again, you have problems in a recent settlement involving Google. Google was funneling most of the CyPRE money to charitable organizations that had been lobbying for Google and Google's preferred policies. And so there wasn't actually any benefit to the class there. This was just Google sending money to organizations affiliated with Google and the plaintiff's lawyers collecting commission without actually having accomplished anything for the class. So these are the concerns I have with CyPRE, and we've had some success in getting courts to pay more attention to this issue. We won a Ninth Circuit case where the charitable recipients were affiliated with the lead plaintiff and with local charities rather than nationwide charities for a nationwide class. And we've had a number of district court cases where the courts have said, no, the money has to go to the class before it goes to any third-party charities. And we'll have another case pending in the Third Circuit very shortly on that same question, where the class was not informed who the CyPRE recipients would be, and money will be going to the CyPRE recipients before it will go to the class members, but the attorneys are getting a full commission on that money going to third parties.
Thank you, Ted. Before we open the call up to callers, do you have questions for one another?
This is Patrick. Not really. I tend to agree with most of what Ted said. The CyPRE should be the last resort, not the first. And I think in the cases that I have, many of them, surprisingly, are full payments. In other words, the people get their money plus the percentage of interest they would be entitled to on the money. The problem is that there's a thing called penetration rate, and that's the percentages that statistically you can figure out based on the type of the class and the geographic scope of the class and the nature of the length of litigation of how many people will actually be able to come in. And the thing which dovetails into the concept of judicial economy is anyone who does class action defense recognizes that the time is the defendant's friend. You know, it's dilly dally, delay and stall is the little plaque you see on some lawyers' walls, and we laugh about it. But the longer you can keep a class action going before a final resolution, either by judgment or by settlement, the more attrition you're going to have of the class membership. And if there's no vehicle that addresses that at the end of the day by making sure that a commitment to pay X actually does pay X, then delay is a reward to one of the parties to the suit. And the justice system doesn't want to do that. And so at the end of the day, if you have a 20% penetration rate and you do not have the way to get the money to the class members, then a CyPRE is a proper thing. And Ted is right that a corporation can game the system by mixing the dollars up. And I agree with that. And in our cases, we make sure that not the defendant picks the charities, We pick the charities with concurrence, and we make sure that the judge approves them. So it's not one party or the other or the judge alone. Everybody has to agree with it, and it's got to be part of the judicial entry. It's made public so that the idea of giving to charities that are financially addressed or directed to some people in the case, that's totally unacceptable. And that's got to be made public by entries that make this clear, so that if anybody sees this, they can immediately go to the Bar Association and say, this is some kind of hunky-dory stuff that's going on. We need to put a stop to it. And I totally agree with him on that. And as finally, on the geographic consistency, I also agree. You can't have a case in Ohio and then give money to the Katrina Hurricane Fund, because the purpose of CyPRAE really isn't necessarily to give the named person the money that they would be entitled to, because if you can, I'm talking about the people who have not claimed. Those people didn't get any money because they didn't make a claim. And you have to make sure that your notice is robust and you do everything possible to find those people, and you make claim processes that aren't hard, that don't have 15-paragraph-long claim forms. Matter of fact, you should just send them a check, as far as I'm concerned. But when you can't find a lot of these people or they've died, then in that type of a situation, then you can have a distribution, not to them, but to their best interest, and that is, can you give money to their family or to somebody close to them who would then benefit them indirectly? And that's the CyPRAE cum possibile. And the problem with what is called, I think, Ted, what do they call it? They call it the consistency doctrine or something, that if the case deals with tobacco, you have to give it to a tobacco charity. That's good for product liability cases, but when you come to fraud cases, it's hard to find a charity that deals with insurance fraud only. And so if you give money to Legal Aid, then 10 of the class members who never got a check because they weren't around, they're not all going to benefit from the Legal Aid. Maybe one of their families will. If you give it to Leukemia and Lymphoma, maybe two of the other families will. But if you give it to a wide variety of organizations in the community where the class members reside, it has to be that same community, then you will indirectly benefit each and every one of them as though they had actually received their dollars.
Ed, do you have any questions?
The issue is, I think avoiding the conflicts of interest and, creating an incentive structure so that the attorney's fees are higher for the money that they actually realize for the class than what they get to the third parties, so that they have the appropriate incentive to maximize class recovery rather than the third-party charitable recovery, and to ensure, ideally that the legislatures are selecting the charitable recipients rather than the attorneys, or that if the attorneys are selecting them, that their selections are constrained in a way that it really is the next best alternative use for the money. And that was the end of the sentence.
Okay. And I will, at the same time that I open up the floor to questions from callers, I will exercise my prerogative as moderator and ask a first question, and then callers can ask a question. My question is for you, Mr. Perotti. I was looking at the various materials that were included with the notice of this conference call, and what caught my attention was the $14 million distribution case. And I was wondering if you could tell us more about what claims were involved in that case, because it, typically if you look at the law reports on CyPRAE cases, there's what's left over is maybe $500,000 or certainly less than $1 million, which in the context of class actions may be a small percentage of the claims at stake. But I guess I'm asking, how did it come about that there was such a large surplusage in that case, and what was the nature of that case?
This was a case against a national insurance company that in the state of Ohio had violated an Ohio Supreme Court decision and had double charged their clients for insurance coverage. The case pended through 5 appeals, and it pended for over 9 years. And at the end of the day, the case actually went to jury trial, and the jury rendered an award of twice the amount that had been asked, because they said that after 9 years, they felt that interest was owed. The judge, of course, then reduced it back down to the correct award and then awarded interest on his own, but had a punitive damages hearing scheduled for the next day. And at the outcome of that case, this shows that the fact that the judiciary, really, a lot of the judges who deal with litigation, they don't often deal with class actions. They're not familiar with what really happens out in the field. And so the defendant said, well, Judge, we're ready to settle the case, so we will pay the jury's verdict and as a settlement, though, and we will pay Mr. Perotti an enormous amount of attorney's fees. And I said, well, we can't talk about that until we have all the other terms done, because that's not ethical. And they said, and therefore, we have a good deal. And the judge said, sounds like it's a fine deal to me. Do you accept it? And I said, well, I have one more question. I said, what happens to the reverter? What happens to the unclaimed funds? And the judge, who's been on the bench for over 20 years, said, what do you mean? I said, well, Judge, I said, there's going to be people who won't be around because the defendant has made this case drag out so long that they won't ever get their money. What's going to happen to those monies? And the defense counsel very quietly said into his handkerchief, well, it goes back to my client. And the judge said, I can't hear you. Repeat that. And he did repeat it. And the judge says, what do you mean it goes back to your client? He said, well, Your Honor, if there's no provision in the settlement agreement for what's called a reverter or a cypre, then under common law, it does go back to the defendant as an undistributed part of the settlement, which he's right about that. And I said, that's the problem, Judge. And I said, unless there's a provision in this settlement agreement that indicates that every dime of the money that they commit to pay out is actually paid out to someone after the class members get every dime they're entitled to with interest, I said, we're not going to have a settlement, because we all know that if it's a judgment that's rendered in that amount, the defendant doesn't get back one dime if it's not distributed. The court has an obligation judicially to then do something with that money other than giving it back to the defendant because of the concept of disgorgement and deterrence. And that's what happened in that case. Was it was such a large case that we knew that these people who each got 169% of the money that was owed to them, they got every dime they were owed plus all the interest over the 9 years. We knew that even with that, there were going to be probably over 60% of the people would not get money. They simply wouldn't get because of the length of time that had elapsed. And that's why there was such a large amount of unclaimed funds, and that's why our settlement agreement insisted that that money not revert to the defendant, but instead it be disgorged, and that it be disgorged after the plaintiffs were all compensated 100% plus interest to charities throughout the state of Ohio.
Thank you. We'll take questions from callers now.
A question about the references both speakers have made, and court decisions and articles also talk about the cypre concept, an award that's as close to the purpose. But in my own practice, I see a problem with that for class action settlements. The problem is that many defendants in these cases settle them, even at large dollar amounts, for what they consider to be nuisance, to get rid of a case, or a way to deal with a risk. And the last thing that those defendants want would be a cypre award that is as close as possible to the subject matter on which they've been sued. As a practical business matter, they would rather prefer a cypre award that would go to general charities. And I wonder whether both of the speakers have encountered that particular issue in their own practices.
Ted, would you like to go first?
I'm not privy to every single charitable settlement and who is selecting the charities. I mean, sometimes it's even just a mediator trying to break a logjam without recognizing the need to sort of comply with certain strictures on where this cypre money should go. But my sense is that if a defendant doesn't want money to go to where it's supposed to go, then they need to decide whether they really want to settle the case. And, you know, the sort of compromise where the defendant is going to agree to pay money to, you know, the sort of third-party charity in lieu of actually doing something for the class, class counsel shouldn't be agreeing to that. And, you know, I had a defense attorney friend, and I won't name him, but he told me with great glee how he once structured a settlement so that the charitable recipient was a college friend of his who had opened up a charity, and then told me, but I'm not telling you what the docket number of the case is, because I don't want you coming in and messing it up. But you know, that sort of thing happens, and I think there's a problem there.
And this is Patrick. I agree totally with the caller that the idea of allowing the defendant the unbridled discretion to say it's going to go to A versus B is not wise, and it's not the way the courts that I've dealt with have done it, because at the very least, because I've insisted that that not be the choice. That if there's a way that you can tailor the recipients of the third-party money to a cause or an organization that is going to get at the root of what is the basis of the lawsuit, for example, if it's a tobacco suit, then it would be likely to some type of charity that promotes smoking prevention, that promotes accurate product disclosures and those things. Those are truly the teeth that would make the defendant, as Ted said, maybe not want to reach the settlement, but when they do reach the settlement, then they have to be aware that it's going to go, if the system is done right, and I think I try to do it that way, it's going to go to something that's not just going to benefit the class, but it's going to put some teeth in the idea of deterrence that next time, defendant, maybe you shouldn't engage in this conduct in the community.
Okay, we'll proceed to our next question.
Hi, I have two quick follow-up questions for Patrick based on some of the information he gave. And then given that I'm practicing in Florida, I wanted to ask both of the speakers if you have any insights on the development of the doctrine in Florida or in the 11th Circuit. But first, Patrick, you had mentioned six states that mandate Cypress, and so I just wanted to ask you to repeat those for me because I missed them all. And you had also mentioned, I think, a Perrier case, and you were discussing that opinion. I was wondering if you could give me that full case name.
Sure. The six states that have mandated Cypress rather than just codifying the doctrine are the states of Washington, Illinois, Massachusetts, North Carolina, South Dakota, California, and Utah. The ones that have codified the doctrine but do not require it are Tennessee, the District of Columbia, and Colorado. The case that I cited to you before, which was, let's see, Perrier, I find that in a second. And while I'm looking for that, I'm not familiar with the specific rule that is followed in the 11th Circuit or in the state courts in the state of Florida. Perrier is Pearson, P-I-E-R-S-O-N, versus Source Perrier, S-A, which is 848 FedSup 1186, and it's a very long opinion that's got some very interesting and thorough analysis.
Thank you.
With respect to what's happening in Florida, I'm aware of one recent federal decision involving Bank of America overdraft litigation, and right up front, the parties decided that 14% of the settlement of a $410 million settlement fund would be going to third-party charities without any rights of class members to make a claim on it, even though the case was settling for 9 cents on the dollar. And I know there were objectors there who objected to that provision, and the judge rubber-stamped it anyway, and the class council collected a 30% commission on this money going to a charity that is still yet to be named. And it looks like everyone's going to get away with it because the plaintiff's attorneys went on to pay off all the objectors to drop their appeals, which is unfortunate. But that's generally why the law is so poor in the class action settlement arena. Until the right case presents itself for the 11th Circuit to weigh in, I worry that we're going to be seeing business as usual among the courts in Florida.
Okay, we'll move on to the next question.
Yes, this question relates to the Elf Attisham case, the Collier versus Elf Attisham case that Ted referred to before. And to what extent do you think that case may contain the answer as a matter of law that's going to bind all the circuits eventually? Because the Fifth Circuit in that case held as a matter of due process, the class members own the settlement fund, and it can't be paid to a Cypress recipient until every class member is made whole. And with respect to the BOA settlement that was just mentioned, to the extent the 11th Circuit decides to follow the 5th, it would seem that that settlement will be thrown out because, as you said, the class members who have been identified are only getting 9% of their damages. And the Cypre is as you said, 14% of the fund is $51 million that's being skimmed right off the top that could be going to the rest of the class and giving them, you know, for example, 15% of their damages instead of 9%.
Well, the 11th Circuit's never going to get to see the Bank of America case because all of the objectors were paid to go away and probably far more than their overdraft fees. So that $51 million is just going to be shuffled off somewhere rather than going to the appropriate class members. And yeah, I don't know what the resolution to that is. It's not like the State Bar Association is going to honor an ethical complaint when the judge approved the settlement. As for Elf Adeshem, my experience has been that settling parties have that the facts of that case involved a settlement that did not explicitly name a Cypre recipient. And every time we raise Elf Adeshem and ask courts to follow it, the settling parties come in and say, oh, but that settlement didn't name a Cypre recipient, and our settlement does name a Cypre recipient, so it's distinguishable. And unfortunately, to date, the district court's ruling on it have refused to follow it. Like I said, we have a case pending in the Third Circuit. Maybe we can get some clarification there. The Elf Adeshem case did not go as far as it could have, and this will need to continue to be litigated.
Okay, the next person.
Hi, I had a question also about the supplemental checks. Ted has kind of convinced me that this is Walter Olson, by the way. Ted has kind of convinced me that the right policy objective is to use the fund to send supplemental checks to the class members, at least if they're below 100% of their damages. But I wondered, are there practical difficulties? It sounds like a pretty straightforward thing administratively to do. Patrick, in particular, are there things that would go wrong on this? And if it is as easy as it looks to send the supplemental checks, how does this apply in cases where there were coupon settlements or some other type of, you know, related other than direct checks being sent in the first place?
You can imagine cases where it would be infeasible. You can imagine a case where there are a million claimants and then there's only $50,000 left over and the administrative cost of giving out 5 cents to everybody just isn't worth the candle. There has to be some judicial flexibility there. But in cases like a securities case where there's only going to be one distribution, there's just simply no reason to identify a Cypre recipient off the bat and say everything goes to the Cypre, you know, that we're setting aside $2 million to the plaintiff's attorney's alma mater while the class gets to share another $14 million. There's no reason not to create a single $16 million fund in the first place and avoid the problem of two separate distributions.
This is Patrick. That's exactly the whole point of it, is where you have a situation that in the cases we do, we don't have a threshold designation of an organization and amount of money because we don't know. Because at the end of the day, we have to see who has taken their checks and who has received their payments. And if there is some money left over that could, I guess, economically, as Ted said, be sent out without the cost of postage and handling exceeding the amount of the check, then those monies can go to enhance the amount of money that a claimant gets, but not as a windfall. I mean, there are some commentators and authors who actually write that the class members should always get the extra money, even if it would triple or quadruple or quintuple their recovery beyond what they actually lost. And that makes class actions into a lottery, and I totally oppose that.
I don't know that I would oppose that. I mean, we see, you know, it's rare that you see a class action a complaint that doesn't seek punitive damages on top of everything else, and you want to incentivize class members to make the claims. And ironically, If you hold out the promise that class members can recover quadruple their damages, you make it less likely that there'll be leftover money in the first place that would quadruple the damages in the first place because you'll get many more claims. In the classmates.com settlement, Judge Richard Jones said, no, there will be no Cypre. Everybody will make their claims, and then you take the $3.5 million settlement funds, and you subtract the attorney's fees, and you divide up the rest among the class. And if class members get $20, class members get $20, and if they get $5, they get $5. That case was a little more difficult because it was very clear that if every class member got made a claim, they would be getting a very, very tiny percentage of the alleged damages. But again, it's a very rare scenario where the class action settlement with the claims process is not only paying a fraction of the alleged damages.
Well, that's what they were going to be doing. The De Beers settlement is they were going to give out pro rata to the fund, regardless of how much the claim the individuals had. But I still have, I understand that the deterrence factor for the class member getting extra money and that encourages them to come forward. But I still have a hesitation that a lot of judges that I know, and a lot of defendants and defense counsel I know, would be willing to agree to an award that essentially looks like punitive damages when, in fact, there is no punitive damages in the case and not available in the case. Because a lot of people think, well, it's a class action, so that means attorney fees automatically get paid, and the answer is they don't. A class action is simply the multiplier of the individual's claim, and if the individual doesn't have a right to receive attorney's fees, then their $30 is all they get paid. They don't get 30 plus the counsel's fees. The counsel's fees must come from that 30. And when you start adding money onto the 30 that the person is owed, again, to me, it plays into the criticizers of class actions that say the class actions are just a big lottery. And I see the problem with that on that end, too. So,
I think one can distinguish between the sort of cases. I have a case involving Volkswagen, and the individual claims when class members can make claims are large three, small four digits. So, those sorts of windfalls, I think, would be inappropriate if a class member would get double or triple that. But when you're talking, the sort of settlements where class members are making a claim for $5.
If it gets
$12 or $15 instead of $5, that's compensating them for the time and trouble of making a claim. Class members' time is valuable, too, my experience in making claims for class actions is that invariably my time was worth more than the amount I
claim
would
was worth. Yeah.
I only make the claims in class actions just so that I can be able to make a statement to the court. Your Honor, this claims process took me 12 minutes, and I'm somewhere in the middle 2/3 of class members and in ability to fill out claims forms. It doesn't disturb me too much if class members are getting $15 for their $4 box of cereal.
Okay. Once again, to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So we'll go on to the next question.
This is Joe McLaughlin in New York. Why is it not the rational response for a defendant to insist as part of the settlement on a gross-up? And could a court really quarrel with a defendant that achieved that in the settlement?
What do you mean by gross up?
That means that the people who do file claims get to share the amount of the settlement that is not applied for by the other members of the class.
You certainly see settlements structured like that.
But why is it not the rational course for every defendant in order to avoid the corrupting influences or conflicts that we discussed earlier to insist on that?
Well, because defendants like giving money to charity, and it's a way to make a settlement cheaper if it's money that they would have given to charity anyway, or if they can get some public relations from it, or if it's a charity that makes the defense counsel happy and they feel better about the settlement than otherwise. And you know, some of the problem is that you have some class action settlements out there, and then there's really no injury. It's just a pure nuisance suit. You will never get more than 1,000 claims. I saw a case out of federal court in Missouri with a class of 5 digits or so, 20 or 30,000 people, and there were 2 claims. And it wouldn't make sense to give each of those class members $250,000. So the money ended up going to charity. But I think when you have cases where there's only going to be 2 claims, or in the grand theft auto settlement where there are only 2,600 claims out of a 10 million member class, for a judge to say, wait a second, is there really an injury here? Is there really a legitimate lawsuit here, or is this pure extortion to generate an attorney fee? Judge Easterbrook in the Seventh Circuit last year in the In Re Aquedots product liability litigation, and that's somewhere in 654F3rd, said that when you have a class representative and a class counsel generating a lawsuit that isn't expected to actually generate any material improvement to the class, but it's there to generate costs to the defendants and force the defendant to pay the attorney's money, that there's a real 23A4 adequacy problem. And I think courts should consider that line of reasoning a bit more closely, and you would see fewer of these problems.
That's what, Patrick, that's why a lot of these cases look to the other aspect, and that is the defendants don't ask for a gross-up, because most of the defendants in most of these cases don't ask for anything as far as cypre or reverter. As I said at the very beginning of the presentation, they simply leave the issue silent, because the default is that if there's nothing said, then whatever money has not been claimed goes back to them very quietly. And I'll tell you, if there's any judges on the phone, I know that I've had judges on all levels of the bench in our state and a number of federal judges who have said to us, I didn't realize, because the judge usually isn't involved in the actual administration process of paying the claims. They simply get a closeout notice at the very end that the parties sign that say all the terms and conditions of the final approval order have been met, and therefore the case is terminated, and the case then terminates in the clerk's office. And the court doesn't watch at the end of the day what exactly is happening to A, B, C, and D, and they're not supposed to under Rule 23. And the fact is then, they're not aware, and they've told me, I wasn't aware that at the end of the day, when your deal said that there was going to be a $3 million settlement, that if there was money left over, it went right back to the defendant. You didn't tell us that. And the defense counsel said, because the settlement agreement didn't say anything else, and that's the default. And they're absolutely right, that is the default. And that's why you don't see these demands for this, because the preference among most defendants is, I want to get as much money back as possible while I make the settlement look as big as possible. And to me, that's not transparent and that's not honest. If you say $3 million, you pay $3
million. Look, I fully agree that that is the desired outcome if you can get away with it. If you cannot get away with it, and the agreement provides that you're not getting a dime back no matter what, I think I might rather, as a defendant, have a gross-up provision than leave to the tender mercies of the court and counsel on both sides to figure out which charity gets it.
And there is, I mean, certainly we see gross-up settlements out there, so there are clearly defendants who think that way, and then we never have the cypre problem in the first place.
And Peggy, do you have any closing thoughts, or any of the speakers have any closing thoughts that you would like to make?
Yeah, I have one final question. This is for Attorney Perotti. I was interested in your opening remarks when you talked about the truth in settlement issues involved when there is a reversion of the settlement amount to the defendant. But it seems to me that there's just as much a truth in settlement issue as if the settlement is structured so that at the end of the day and without much public notice or scrutiny, the plaintiff's counsel is given discretion, a great deal of discretion, to name charities to which the surplusage goes, and that does not typically get any exposure either.
That's a really good point, and that's the sort of two-edged sword that Ted said earlier, that a lot of times when these things happen, there's a lot of fault around, there's a lot of publicity, and there's a lot of media. That's what our firm does is we make sure that this is done very publicly, not because I want to have a benefit for Dworkin and Bernstein, because as I say in these presentations, these organizations, this isn't my money. This is Progressive's money or Grange's money or Verizon's money or AT&T's money. But there has to be in the settlement agreement and in the final approval order and in the preliminary approval order, in all the court orders and very publicly, an indication that this is part of the deal, how the part of the deal works, who's going to get the money, how it's structured, how it's determined on both ends. And that doesn't mean that there can't be a reverter in some of these cases. In some cases, a portion of the money can revert so long as the parties agree to it and put it in black and white in the settlement agreement. And that's why a lot of the conservatives in Ohio said, so long as that legislation says that it must only go based on what the order says, they'll support it, because the defendant can always say, no, I want 18% or 28% or 54% of this money back if it's not claimed. And if that's the deal the parties reach and the court approves it, then that's what it should be. But it should be very clear, as you said, on as to all issues.
On the other hand, the website's called Ohio Lawyers Give Back rather than Ohio Lawyers Clients Give Back.
Well, I don't think it's even the clients giving back. I think it's the defendant who's giving the money away, because they're the ones who agreed to the site pay provision in the first place. So,
Peggy, is there anything further?
No, that was it. Thank you.
Well, thanks everyone. Once again, we thank you for calling in, Mr. Perotti, Mr. Frank. Again, we thank you for participating in our discussion today. Thanks everyone.
Thanks, Ted. Thanks, Peggy.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.